Hello, and welcome to the Growth Mindset Podcast, your weekly dose of inspiration and exploration. Join me, your host, Sam Harris, as I discover how mindset can help you do incredible things through my conversations with the world's most interesting people, from tech billionaires to leading scientists, best-selling authors to notorious hackers. The goal is to increase our collective wisdom and attitudes to make us all happier and healthier, wiser and wealthier. Who doesn't want that? Today we have James Potten on the podcast. He is the Managing Director of Red Academy, who do training courses for developers, designers, and growth hackers. So I've known James for a long time, and he used to be my mentor for my first business when he was running his own recycling company. He then later went on to sell this business and did pretty well for himself. And he's just always been a source of great advice for me. And so it was only a question of time before I eventually had him on the podcast. So I'm pleased to say he didn't disappoint me with the interview. And you can really tell that he puts a lot of thought into his words and that there's just a lot going on behind each point that he makes. So be sure to listen attentively as we discuss the tips and pitfalls of building businesses and the future of work.
Great to be here. Been awesome listening to some of your other podcasts. A brief arc of where I am today. At the moment, working on a project called Red Academy. It's a design and tech school. Started out in Vancouver about 3 years ago, and it's been then opened a school in Toronto. And I was fortunate enough to meet one of the co-founders out in LA 2 years ago, and got chatting about lifelong learning, like where we're going in terms of exponential tech and what's happening and how we need to do more to solve the digital skills gap and what's coming, AI and automation. Next thing I know, the school's over there and on a journey to bring Red to London. So it's a year later, and now I've been on the ground, and we've got 22 students all learning design, so dev work and digital marketing, so the hipster, the hacker and the hustler. So how I got here, I was fortunate enough to get into windsurfing when I was younger. Found that I was quite good at it. Just got used to being a bit of a, coming from the island of misfit toys. Won my first race, went and did a regional event, won that, then did a national event, and then committed to going on a journey. Ended up getting in the British youth team, and by age 14, I had a coach, which was now, looking back, one of the most amazing things to have had. You've got someone who's getting you to think about what you did when you won that race. What was it that made you be in the right headspace for the right? And then obviously just the wider event series, all these type of things. So, and then I got to uni and started the Windsurf Club. Hadn't really been running. There's about the 30 of us in it. We sort of grew up to 170 in the next year. And that was my first experience of entrepreneurial world, doing fun stuff and making impactful things happen with a great group of people. Left uni, went back, had done an apprenticeship, went back to Honeywell, found it quite hard being in that big organization, and jumped ship after a couple of years. I went up to Melbourne, LA. That was my 12 years and when I sort of cut my teeth on understanding how business worked. And the first 6 years, it was really hard and hadn't really got the understood the importance of culture.
And this is running your own business, is it?
Yeah, the next 6 years, it just started to fly with the right people in the right seats on the bus. And just that was amazing. Decided I wanted to get across to tech. I'd always been a geek, learned to program as X Spectrum at age 6. And I think in sustainability, there's a lot of people who know the questions that need answering. It can be quite a hard world in the tech space. There's loads of positivity and there's loads of people who know how to answer questions, but don't always know what the right questions are. So
yeah.
That was my idea, and to get across and be a bridge. And that's actually what happens within Red, because the students work on impact and not-for-profit and charities to embed their learning. So, a
few different things that you glossed over that would be good to learn more about. So coaching, because I first met you as a coach for myself. It'd be interesting to hear a bit more of what your best advice is for coaching someone and the benefits of having a coach.
Yeah, sure. The simplest way to describe it is, if you look at sort of Jungian theory around the 12 archetypes, or disc model, where you've got the red, yellow, green, blue quadrants, and it's based on whether you're more introverted or extroverted, or whether you're more task or people orientated on the two axes, everyone's going to have a bias towards certain ways of thinking. And if you look at Johari's window, you've got known knowns, known unknowns, and unknown unknowns. So you've got this situation where you've got a blind spot that you don't necessarily realize even exists, because you don't know that it's there. So a coach can help you unlock or start to realize or reflect or learn to self-reflect on where am I in this and what role am I playing in the way that I feel about the situation or the way that something's playing out. So it's the concept of looking in before you look out, because most of the answers are already within you. You just need someone to help unlock them.
Okay. If someone couldn't afford a coach, what would be the best questions they could ask themselves or get someone else to ask them?
I would recommend more action experiments. So I know that I'm in a system or I'm in any situation, I am in it and part of it. So think about making a change or a small change and see what happens as a result of that change. So you can personally self-adjust and self-modify if you don't have someone to help you do it. It's also hypothesized. Think about what you think will happen as a result of a small change. And it could be just in a relationship where you greet someone, you just change that small bit and see what difference that has. It's a very simple thing and see how that can change and look open to the feedback.
Okay. Then you said you started the Windsurfing Society at university. How did you bring that all together and make it a success?
Yeah, my repeated behavior actually is to come into something when it's already just formed. I end up seeing like potential within it. I've repeatedly done that. So the Windsurf Club had folded the year before. Someone had picked it up and just started to get it going again. And uni came along and we worked out that we needed funds to run the club and get equipment because all the equipment had been sold. So we went to a few events. We won those events. We go back to the union and say, look, starting to get results. Can we get some money to get some kit? So they then funded us and we started winning more events. This is how we get funds, which is going out, winning university events. The other one is the amount of people that you're bringing through. So we then invested in equipment for beginners and made sure that every Wednesday afternoon we'd go down to the lake and teach people windsurfing, and then started to get known for giving up our time and helping people get into the sport. And it wasn't an amazing experience on this little lake in South Wales, but it was enough to give people a taster and get into it. So, and then we had built a social calendar and were very active, and nearly every week we'd have something that we were doing. And it was before the internet had come through, so I think I got my Third Uni in 96 and I got my Hotmail account in 98. It was just internal emails within the university, but we used that as a means of communication to get people. It was weird how quickly everyone adopted. The only other way to communicate with a group of people was on the messaging boards. So you'd have to go into the university, walk down the corridor, get to the windsurfing board and put, we're meeting in this pub at 7 p.m. on Thursday. And that was the only other way that everyone could go and find out what was going to happen. Email list started to make a massive difference. And we made sure that we also got in the student paper, and it meant that people could see what we were up to. We then started winning awards. We started the Student Windsurf Association because there was about sort of 8-10 active clubs in the UK, and there was about 5 windsurf events. So we created the website, coded in Python, and we were trying to a membership portal so you could register, say what university you were with. And we actually managed in the space of just a few years, go from about 10 or 12 clubs. We ended up with 47 university windsurf clubs. And we also created the largest windsurf event in the UK. It was 800 students coming to learn to windsurf over a weekend. It was in Weymouth at the time, now it's in Devon. But the formula there was also that it was all one design kit. So if a uni didn't have the money, they could just buy one board. So brilliant thing about that is that A, it's accessible to everyone, but B, it's not about who's got the most money.
Okay, so then moving on to, actually, you did remind me about something you told me about a long time ago. Said you used to have a bit of a party house at uni, and somehow this is how you met your wife, but I don't remember the story at all.
Yeah, at uni we had the house where we'd often the front door was left open and people would just be passing to go to university. Sort of the house that people from the Windsurf Club and that group was central sort of focal point for people to just get together. So we'd often run a punch party at our house before going out. It was a lot of fun. I would have not wanted to rent to us. I lived there for about 8 years. I decided to grow up a bit after about 6 years and moved out from the floor I was on into a flat by myself, one floor below. So I still had access to the fun floor. And my wife moved in there about a year after that. She put on sort of Gumtree that she was a kite surfer and a snowboarder. So it was a
good start.
Yeah.
Cool. Okay. Then moving on to, so you then started the business in Bristol. You had like 6 years of it not going too well. So that sounds like quite a long time. It must have done quite all right to start off with and be paying wages.
It was just hard in the startup quite some time. And it was interesting. I just ran a panel recently on diversity and inclusion. The concept of it being two axes, so diversity on one and inclusion on the other. And it's more important to create an inclusive culture before you try and create diversity. So we were like 3 guys. We then got 4th guy. we then just keep getting more and more guys we need to get on the team. We need cognitive diversity and different ways of thinking. And a girl joined us, and we were all quite task orientated. So we were always sat in four corners and came in and say hello to each other, we're friendly, but we'd just come in, get our work done and leave. For her, I don't think she enjoyed that way of working, and she left after a couple of months, and then we got another girl in, and it only started to really work when we made time to build solutions together.
Okay, and then how did you have the resilience to do that for 6 years?
It's always around believing in what you're doing. I've always needed to truly believe that what I'm doing will make a difference. If you believe that, you'll get through. At some point, it will manifest. You just need to find the route through. Same as Red. Now, Red was hard to get to work in London. The concept, it was meeting a new audience with a different mindset to North America. And amazing now to see it going on the journey that it deserves to do. And amazing to see what it's now doing for the students. But it was hard to convince people in the early days that it could solve what they needed. It's often like pushing and pushing, and then they laugh at you. It then truly, people get it, and it starts to take on a life of its own.
Cool. Yeah, so I guess you also had the issues of, like, there's the other boot camps in London that already had a brand image and never knew about those.
Yeah, and how do you differentiate? That's always a question that people ask. How is it different? And we actually don't use the term boot camp for what we do. It's a agency style of learning. We're trying to create the first 3 months. People say, I learned more than the first 3 months of work, university years. Try and create those first 3 months. So it's the students were working on real projects and they're embedding the learning. And it's 10% retention after 2 weeks with chalk and talk. And it's a 90% retention if you've actually applied it to a real life situation. That's our differentiator. But it's how we teach, and it's heart led. It's around learning is an emotional response to something. It's social. It's learning together. And if you can build a learning experience within a group, it accelerates. And that's going back to my finance consultancy days. The turning point was moving into outskirts of Bristol, so near a university sort of hub area. People could cycle to it and started a graduate program. So it was a 13-week program to take someone from not knowing anything about what we do to being able to have their own clients. And so we started to bring new energy, new life into the organization.
Cool. Yeah. What do you think about the future of work and the future of learning? Do you think people will still be going to university or reskilling and changing and having like multiple careers? Is that something you're trying to enable? Or
yeah, I mean, it's really exciting, that double-edged sword of technology. There's always first technology discovered would heat you, cook your food, and it could also burn you, cut down. There's always going to be gains and losses, and hopefully the gains are greater than the losses. So there's going to be roles that disappear. The whole model of employment could change. In fact, I think it's 2027 that freelance roles will outweigh employed roles. So there's an amazing opportunity for people who feel more comfortable with being a bit more free-spirited, sort of more nomadic, wanting to live and work where they choose, picking up work for periods of time, or even just doing a few hours or a few days a week. So it brings loads of different options, but it changes the relationship of who's responsible for learning, because businesses aren't going to necessarily invest in a freelancer's education. So the freelancer will need to invest in themselves, invest in their own learning. Freelancer will need to keep ahead of what's happening to get the next gig. So, and then I think companies will end up being a smaller group of employed people and bringing in the more radical thinkers as freelancers move them or the product forwards.
Okay, then back to changing track a little bit. When you were saying after 6 years, you started getting things together with your business and have like the right bumps on the right seat. How did you actually get the right bums on the right seats? What were the questions you were asking, and how are you thinking about things differently?
So my business partner and I, we recognized that we needed support at board level. So we brought in non-exec, and that actually really started to change things by having someone who could lower the rope down and help us up. So we had a non-exec come and join us. Brian was an amazing guy. And we brought in a sales trainer who was looking to help us become more commercially minded as an organization, but was also a coach, and she massively helped us develop ourselves and develop the business. And so investing in our learning and our education and getting people that had been there and had grown organizations or had been successful to help us understand how to get there. So it was mostly being open to outside help to develop the organization.
And then internally, what were like your favorite questions or interview strategies to make sure that you really found the right person that fit the business?
We used a sifting process for the initial applicants based on what was put in the CV. We always used the scoring system. So we have 50, what level do we think this person is? We then get them in for an interview. At that point, looking to see whether there was congruence between what was in the CV and what they were saying, but also looking to see, is there a fit? And so, I mean, I recently went to a UX event on employability, and one of the panelists said he asked himself three questions when he's interviewing someone. Do I like you? Do I like you? And do I like you? It's quite important. Like, and that's why we spend so much time at Red looking at the soft skills or the team skills. Say the soft skills are the hardest to learn. And like businesses say, the biggest challenge with people coming out of university is they don't know how to work within a team. It's about what is a high performing team and how can you be part of one and being open to giving feedback, but receiving feedback as well.
So how did a setback or a failure set you up for later success?
All of my biggest mistakes have been around decisions around people. When you're building a company, it's the people that are within it that make it. So yeah, I've had times where I haven't picked up on certain things about someone and that's bitten me. And so yeah, I've learned to trust my spidey sense a lot more on that, but also bring in different people in interview processes to try and get different points of view and pick up on things again. Because we've got the blind spot, going back to Johari window, there's things that you may not see that someone else will see. So I really rely on having a range of different people in the interview process to help, because it's always so time consuming if it doesn't work out with someone. For me, that's my biggest learn, and it's the area in which I try and put so much care and attention into in terms of who joins.
The problem is that the person you hire is then just bad for the company or toxic.
Yeah, it just depends. I mean, there's loads of different ways it can play out. Sometimes they're not, what's in the CV isn't actually what they've necessarily done or who they are.
So how would you know that that person has the skills? Does that work? If you're hiring a developer, they could say some things about code and you'd be like, oh, great, you're awesome. And then they get there and they actually can't do anything.
Yeah, my skill appears to be finding really awesome people to work with, but it needs to be beyond that as well. They also need to be able to deliver what they say they do. So I would always look to bring in an expert in the area they're going to be, the role in which they're fulfilling. So it's not just the culture fit and the energy and the passion for what we're doing, it's they are actually able to deliver.
Okay, cool. So it sounds like you've done a lot of learning and giving yourself up for different roles. How do you use the growth mindset in your attitude to things?
I've always had like a thirst to learn, but I know there was a particular trigger or point where I became more open. It was like this period of accelerated learning. It was around 2012. Started to listen to podcasts, get introduced to people like Peter Diamandis, and it was Tony Robbins at the time. And Peter Diamandis' concept of abundance, and if we think we can solve the world's problems, or we think we can, we're right, so we better start thinking we can. And that trigger, that moment of going, like, that's what I believe that we can, and I want to be surrounded by people that believe we can, and that's my journey, and just start then opening up. So I used to record my notes into tape recorder and play them back to myself. I learned much more. So the whole opening up the world of podcasts and audiobooks and so on meant that I could learn so much quicker. So that was the trigger for me. And I could just go on my own learning journey with things I was really excited about, which was all about how we think and how people work together and where we're going with technology and what does that mean for society and what does that mean for where we might end up and how do we make that an inclusive and hopeful place rather than a dystopian future.
Cool. And what's the biggest risk you've taken?
Whenever there's a fundamental change in life, like leaving Honeywell and going and joining actually a three-person startup, that was a big risk. But it hadn't closed the door on being able to ever go back and work for Honeywell. That's the thing. It's the monkey bar analogy. Humans need to see the new bar before they were willing to let go of the old one. And the likelihood of not being able to get back to that old one is very small. There's generally always opportunities. And it's just realizing there's way more opportunities out there than we're open to. So doing that within that organization where we were the smallest player entering the new market, which was batteries recycling, that we had to sit down, me and my business partner, and I remember the phone call saying, okay, this is 120,000, I think, investment, which was a lot of money to us at that point. And bearing in mind that the other two regulations that we worked in, one was free and one was £12,000 to enter. So it was this huge difference to enter that market. That was big because that may not have worked. And that was enough for the organization not to be there. Yeah, that was a massive risk, but taking that risk was almost the catalyst for us driving and being so determined to make it happen. It mattered so much. And so there are risks that I've taken. I've done it again, going on the journey with Red, and I'd say the thing is humans don't naturally want to put themselves in a position of danger. So we will try to avoid it, but it's actually the point of highest risk is where the most opportunity because other people aren't entering it.
Yes, and you risk more by not taking so much risk in that you're not going to commit to it as much, then you won't bother. But if you're there with like, okay, this has to work.
That has to work actually is self-prophesizing it. It causes it to work because if you have an abundant mindset, you believe that you can make it work.
So the biggest risks are not taking big risks.
Exactly.
Cool. I like it. What are you worried about?
In a wider context, people like easy answers. It's much easier to sell fear. I mean, the papers are loving Brexit. It's like heyday again. For the papers haven't been going off the shelf as fast since the internet started. It's just this crazy, insatiable need to stoke the fear within people. And it's just so unhelpful. And you see it within like US presidential elections and so on. And it just takes us in the wrong direction. And recently had some discussions with liberals and their challenges, like the messaging. How do you get across the complexities of leaving Europe in a snazzy side of the bus, like one bullet point? Whereas for the Brexiteers, much easier to shove the 350 million on the side of the bus that will be repatriated. You can explain the complexities of the impact. And because humans like easy answers, it's much easier because we make decisions with our heart, not our head. It's always ultimately an emotional decision, even if we post-rationalize. It's much easier to hook onto one very simple message than it is to look at the complexities of the relationship of the UK with the EU and what impact that would have trying to pull out. I think that my fear is that we become lazy and seek just easier and easier answers. I just recently read 21 questions by Yuval Harari, and he said, we're investing all this money in artificial intelligence. Let's not forget to invest some in human intelligence too.
Good point. I like it. Then what is your thing? If I was to ask someone else, what's something that James does that's pretty uniquely James?
In a group setting, I'm willing to push the edges or the boundary of something. Me and my friend Andy, we were running the SWA together. We always talk about pushing the envelope and like life begins at the edge of your comfort zone. So it's pushing that boundary in thought within a work context, within a facilitated session with a great group of people in the room. I'm willing to try to push the divergent thinking. I'm willing to throw that crazy idea out there, which pulls people from where they are, pulls them out of the comfort zone a bit, and you might just shift slightly towards it and find a more optimum. Something that you wouldn't have if you weren't willing to diverge. The double diamond is so important in the creative process of design thinking. It's so important to diverge. And I've done a master's in mechanical engineering. I'm a convergent thinker. I love to converge on an answer and get that solved and move on to the next thing. It's actually like within a team of people, it's trying to open up that space to create divergent thinking because that's how you outsolve problems against your competitors or in a landscape where no one knows the answer.
Okay. What is your most vivid memory from childhood?
Yeah, I was just really lucky to grow up in the countryside. So I just remember having the space and freedom to run up and down the garden with my dog. And it always seemed to be sunny when you were younger as well. So it's just being outside. We just lived next to a farm. It was awesome. It's not what I seek right now. I love living in the city and I love the energy that I get from living in the city.
Hey, what was the naughtiest thing you ever did as a child?
Funny thing was we weren't allowed sort of like down into town. Too often I had to say like when I was going and what I was doing. And I did. I once went down into town without telling mum and dad and got back and dad wasn't home yet. And he came in and asked me what I'd been up to. And I just said I'd been playing in the road or whatever. He was like, all right, because so-and-so Bernard says they saw you down in the town centre. And it was the last time I did it. It was pretty funny.
Did they tell you off a lot?
It was a lesson in not being disingenuous.
Yeah, I do remember I had a teacher said it's fine to break the rules as long as no one ever knows you're breaking the rules. And it kind of makes sense because as long as you don't do something that damages someone else, then it's probably okay. What's the kindest thing that someone has ever done to you?
Well, to be honest, it's the opportunity my parents gave to me, like through supporting me in windsurfing. It was twice a week driving to Weymouth from Somerset, so it's an hour drive. So Tuesday night, Thursday night, and then always pretty much every weekend down by the coast or somewhere. So that's hard, that's dedication. Yeah, in fact, I didn't have pocket money or anything like that, but obviously the equipment costs money, and I always was very grateful that they would fund that and allow me to actually go on that journey. So And if you look at Google did analysis across all of their staff and looked for trends within CVs, and the two things that came through, all of their high performing employees had reached a high level of something and that they'd given back. So someone had done their 10,000 hours and understood what it was like to have mastery of something, and also had recognized that to get on in the world, you need to learn to give first. And so, yeah, those two aspects. So whatever, being working for a charity or having mastered something, so grateful to have been given the opportunity to master something and to actually find your thing that you're good at.
Cool. And then is there anything else you want to ask me?
I've always been super inspired by your amazing journey. You recognize opportunities early on in your career. I mean, you created and sold your first business by 23, 24, but still, that's amazing. I'm interested about what was the thing for you in your growth mindset, the way you dedicated yourself to learning to code, and what was been your secret success?
I guess I do like learning, and I also combated by the flaw of getting bored a bit quickly, and I really like learning and doing exciting things. So I want to take on this new challenge and do this hard thing, which can potentially put you in lots of successful situations, but also you do need to nail down and then stick with the hard thing for another few years. Because I quite like getting to the point of, oh, I know I can do this, but I don't actually want to sit around with it for another 2 years to make it happen. Like, I already know in myself that I can do it. I need to prove the world that it'll get done, which is quite hard. I did that with the first business. I didn't have enough options because I was so busy with uni and other things that kept that going. And since then, I've done a lot of ideas that I could have made successful, but got to the point where I was like, actually, I'm not so interested in this that I want to carry on with this forever, until probably the podcast and, I guess, learning to code and all the other things I've kind of done. They've been successful, they made them happen, but I didn't then keep it going fully, which makes me feel perhaps like a bit of a fraud, or maybe I'm doing the right thing. It's sort of hard to know, but I do.
Certainly agile.
Yeah, I have put myself through a lot of experiences. And then you always look back in like a few years ago or even like a few weeks ago and think, wow, I was so stupid. And now I can look back and think, okay, I definitely just didn't have so many skills to even complete some of the things I thought I could do. And perhaps when I thought that I proved enough, I could finish off this thing, I just didn't have those skills. And it's been quite humbling working on some projects now that I'm working on with people where I'm repeatedly telling them that they're doing the wrong thing. And then a year later, it's like, okay, actually, it's doing really well. Maybe I've got more to learn here. And it's nice exposing myself to these things. And then I guess the podcast has just been so fascinating, talking to lots of people about all the ways they've achieved what they're doing. And then you start to make patterns of what works and what doesn't. Like I say in songwriting, once you know the formula how to write a good song, you can break the rules. Once you've worked out the formula of how to be successful, like some people do break the rules and you see how it works the way they are breaking the rules. But if you just go and think that you can break the rules straight away, then probably not. I recognize that I was probably pretty lucky with my first business. Things just happened to go right rather than because I was some genius or something. So yeah, I'm not sure I fully answered how I'm doing things there, but just interest in trying new things and just
follow things that excite you.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's cool. Really cool.
Nice. Good question. All right, cool. So yeah, thanks a lot for being on the interview there.
Yeah, thanks, man. Really good to see you again and good to catch up.
That's the end of the interview with James, and loads of good advice for us there. So as always, I like to break down my top tips from the interview. And so let's start with number one. Get advice from others. So use mentors and coaches for what you're trying to achieve. If you are running a business, get a non-executive on board and don't just think that you're too smart to do it all yourself. Or if you're hiring, get someone who's actually knowledgeable in the area that you're hiring for. Because there are always things that you can't think of yourself, and you just open yourself up to mistakes by thinking too highly of yourself. So be humble and get other people to help you with things. Number two, focus on the soft skills. So whether you are hiring someone else or improving yourself, it's the soft skills that are really crucially important. There's a really good point, which is a saying that the future of work is dependent on the three C's, which is communication, collaboration, and creativity. And these are the skills that you really need to have in yourself and in others around you just to be able to work with them. And as James says, you get hired for the hard skills, but fired for the soft skills. So you really need to learn to take feedback and value it from others and not think too highly of yourself, again, as I've already said. Number three, life begins at the edge of your comfort zone. And this is a really cool point that James made. If you want to live an interesting life where you take on challenges and have big successes, you need to step out of your comfort zone. You need to embrace the bigger risks, and you'll actually be much more likely to succeed in any risks that you take by committing to them properly. And if you don't have the fire under your ass to make it succeed, it's much less likely to happen. And now on to books. We spoke about the book 21 Lessons for the 21st Century by Yuval Noah Harari. And this is an amazing book about what we should really be focusing on. It just opens your eyes into new ways of thinking about the world as it is and what our priorities should really be as a species. And it's really, really good mind-provoking stuff. So give it a read. Then the other, well, we didn't speak about another book, but we did mention the 10,000 hour rule, which comes from the book by Malcolm Gladwell called Outliers. And it's definitely a worthwhile read if you haven't read it already. He's a great author and he explains concepts in a really nice way that just gets you interested in the topic and just an easy way for you to actually understand things. And I would highly recommend it.
You've just listened to an episode of the Growth Mindset Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on your preferred app and give me a good rating, as these go a really long way. If you are unable to give good feedback right now, try sharing the show with a friend who will, or just wait for the show to improve. If you have any ideas for the show or you just want to chat, then please reach out to me on Twitter at SamHarrisTweets or Instagram at SamJamSnaps. Show notes and other links to topics discussed in the episodes are available at the website, growthmindsetpodcast.com. Thanks so much for listening. Give yourself a big hug from me. If you're with a friend, give them a hug as well. And I hope you enjoy your next podcast.